He's made many comments about how it appeared that DPS was not doing its job because of Wooten. He wanted him fired.
Lawmakers subpoena Todd Palin in their Troopergate investigation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 12th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska's largest Jewish congregation celebrates 50 years.
All of us had a very strong sense of what it was like to be Jewish. And we got all of that in large part because of our parents' commitment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska.
The investigator looking into the events surrounding the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan updated legislators this morning on his work so far, and he issued subpoenas compelling 13 more people to talk to him. However, they might no longer be needed. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Steve Branchflower, the retired state prosecutor, called in to look into abuse of power allegations around the firing of Commissioner Monaghan, says he's taken statements from 16 people who have made contributions to the inquiry. But since the Palin administration backed down from the governor's pledge to cooperate with his work, he says he's gotten little input. Branchflower has partially drawn on documents produced by the Department of Law. However, the department is now advising possible witnesses against making further statements. In a letter yesterday, Senior Attorney General Michael Barnhill expressed concerns that the legislature was looking for possible criminal charges. Branchflower told the Judiciary Committee that all he wants to do is present as much evidence as possible and let others decide on what to do with it. He says decisions about criminal proceedings are left to the executive branch, not the legislative.
There's still a lot of roadway to travel before we get to that decision, and I just don't see that on the horizon. I think that's difficult to foresee. But the direct answer to your question is it would have to be some executive authority, either state or federal.
In a written response, the Legislative Council has agreed with the Department of Law's opinion that criminal proceedings are not the purpose of the investigation. The committee issued 13 subpoenas, most of them to state employees who might have some information concerning the relationship between the administration and Governor Palin's former brother-in-law, Trooper Michael Wooten. Not a state employee, the governor's husband, Todd Palin, was among those included on the list. Investigator Branchflower says Palin has been a principal critic of Trooper Wooten, and he's had many contacts with public safety personnel over several years.
He's made many comments about how it appeared that DPS was not doing its job because of Wooten. He wanted him fired. I don't know if Mr. Palin is represented. I don't know where he is. I'm hoping that the subpoena, if issued, will permit me to interview him. He has spoken to numerous government employees, administration employees, about Mr. Wooten. And I think because he's such a central figure to the events that are the subject of my inquiry, I think one should be issued for him.
Senate Minority Leader Gene Theriault says the committee does not need to issue the subpoenas, calling the investigation political, since the current plan is to release the findings before the November election.
We've got allegations and suspicions in the public now that this investigation is being used as a political tool. Rightly or wrongly, there are a lot of people in the public that have written to me and called me that make that allegation. It was after the council's vote that comments were made about impeachment and October surprises. That's all unfortunate, but you can't put that genie back in the bottle.
Theriault and Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire unsuccessfully supported a motion to delay the subpoenas until after the general election. The House Judiciary Committee issued what it called an advisory, approving the subpoenas but not issuing them. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Judge Emmett Sullivan held an emergency hearing today in Washington, D.C. in the federal case against Senator Ted Stevens. The judge wanted to settle a dispute over whether prosecutors in the case are turning over evidence to the defense in the right format. Erica Bolstad, the Washington, D.C. reporter for the Anchorage Daily News, was there. She says basically the judge agreed with Stevens' lawyers.
And what had happened is that they were getting things in an electronic format where it wasn't easy to divide where or determine where one document began and where another one ended. And so so basically the judge said, you know what, just turn it all over on paper. That way they've got everything and it'll be very clear where one thing begins and one thing ends.
Seems somewhat unusual. You would think that in this connected day and age that that would be standard procedure and it would almost seem more efficient to send things electronically instead of on paper.
I think part of the problem here is that they're working on such a short and such a short time frame for this particular case. It's happening so quickly. And one of their complaints was, look, we can't get to trial on September 22nd. If we have to go through this electronic record and pull things out one by one without any clear definitions where things stop and start, and we're just not going to be able to physically do it unless we have it in a more workable format.
Erica, during the hearing today, did the defense shed any light on the case that they're building?
Yeah, they did. It's pretty interesting what they seem to be talking about, and it's actually not so much as building, but how they might be attacking the prosecution's case. And one of the things that one of the Senator Stevens' lawyers suggested is that they're going to be attacking some of the evidence, including the photographic evidence that was taken of Senator Stevens' home in Girdwood. And what they're going to be doing is suggesting that the photos were taken with a wide-angle lens that make the house and the furnishings and everything in it look bigger than it is. And they have said that they've already got on board an expert who wrote a textbook about crime scene photography. They're going to be using him to attack the photographic evidence in this case.
That seems interesting. I wonder why they wouldn't just provide their own version of the photographs.
Well, and that seemed to be something that the judge has suggested all along. If you want to bring in your own photos, bring in your own photos, too, is what he has said.
So what was the tone of the hearing today? How cordial was this?
You know, you can tell that they're already starting to get a little bit under each other's skin, the prosecution and the defense. The prosecutors basically suggested that they thought that the defense attorneys, when they said jump, that basically they had to jump, and it's simply because, as the lead prosecutor said, because Senator Stevens has U.S. Senator before his name. And the judge was pretty quick to say, wait a second, hold on here. I'm treating everyone the same, and this is no different than any other defendant would be treated.
So, Erica, what's next?
Well, next, there is a major hearing on Thursday next week where they'll kind of finalize all of the remaining disputes they have over evidence and any lingering questions they have before they launch into jury selection the next Monday. And then the trial is scheduled to start on Wednesday, the 24th.
All right. Well, thanks for that update.
Thank you.
Erica Bolstead covers Washington, D.C. for the Anchorage Daily News. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the early success of Anchorage's new native charter school.
Now at school, Alan bounces out of bed every morning. He loves to go to school. And I way underestimated what culture meant to those children.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A 500,000 Alaskans are receiving almost $3,300 in their bank accounts today, thanks to direct deposits of their permanent fund dividend checks and energy relief payments. Paper checks will be mailed out beginning September 30th. The payout is a record this year, and now a group has started a fund to allow Alaskans to contribute a portion of their checks to help rural residents deal with staggering fuel costs in remote communities. The Energy Assistance Program will be administered through the United Way, and donated funds will go to Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC, officials who will help co-op members unable to pay or falling behind on their heating and electricity bills. Fund organizer Nils Andreasen says they wanted a system that was easy.
We didn't want to set up another program or agency or process. We wanted to be able to take advantage of something that was in place that would be very effective and quick, really. So with United Way, we volunteered to act as the fiscal agent. Any money that comes to them direct to the Energy Assistance Fund will just pass through directly to AVEC, who was able to get it out to people who need it.
Andreasen says all Alaskans are facing higher fuel expenses, but the state's extra energy payment is critical for Alaskans in remote communities who are seeing as much as 40% of their income eaten up by fuel expense. He says recent fuel cost studies have identified communities with the highest prices, and AVEC will assist those residents with the funds. Donations are tax deductible. Andreasen hosts a monthly Anchorage Knowledge Industry Network meeting, and he says last month members had a discussion about the energy cost problem and what they could do to help.
Immediately, people were talking about doing a work exchange, getting young professionals here in Anchorage out to rural Alaska to better understand the needs. I think there's a general commitment to engaging in the state's issues and with each other and doing our best to move forward around these things.
The program will not just assist rural Alaskans, although 70% of the funds will go to village communities, 30% will be given to needy families in Anchorage through existing needs-based programs. Andreasen says so far the response has been great, and he thinks it's an excellent example of Alaskans helping Alaskans.
And I hope that that's how many people see it. It's one opportunity for them to take advantage of to help their neighbors and help their neighbors across the state.
A letter from Andreasen and other supporters that explains the concept and the address to mail donations to the United Way of Anchorage is at our website, aprn.org. This year's Southeast Conference annual meeting will focus on energy. The Organization of Southeast Alaska Business and Government Leaders will hear about electrical grid expansion, as well as wind energy, a variety of transportation and economic development issues. The meeting is next week, and it's outside Southeast Alaska, just across the border in Prince Rupert, British Columbia. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
Southeast Conference leaders are looking forward to completion of an intertie connecting the Swan and Tyee Lake hydropower plants. The first major addition to the region's electrical grid in several years will link projects powering Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg. But they say there's far more to be done, especially for villages. Craig City Administrator John Bowling is Conference Board President.
Because those communities rely on diesel generation, they're paying a very high price per kilowatt hour. And our goal is to help facilitate the development of line extensions to these communities, especially in the near term, Huna and Cake.
Power line and other energy issues are among the topics for the conference meeting. The group will hear from its own energy coordinator, tribal and state officials, and developers of an offshore wind project in British Columbia. They'll also discuss the organization's work as a regional advisory council for a state Labor Department job training effort. Conference Executive Director Shelley Wright says the focus is to meet the region's occupational needs while preparing trainees for employment.
Nursing is certainly a priority in Southeast Alaska. And construction, road work. We tried to tie some of the needs in with the AGEA job descriptions because, of course, everyone, if they have an opportunity to go up north, is going to take that opportunity.
Conference members will also take up a variety of transportation, fishing, and timber issues. The annual meeting usually takes place in a southeast city, but this year it's in Prince Rupert, British Columbia, about 100 miles southeast of Ketchikan. Wright says they've met there before.
We just really have always considered Prince Rupert a partner to Southeast Alaska, as we consider the Yukon a partner to Southeast Alaska because of our borders. Skagway, the northern end of Southeast, you know, deals a lot within the Yukon, and then down at the southern end, Prince Rupert has always been a partner in economic development with Ketchikan and the people down there in the southern end.
Rupert will hold a trade export conference, including tours of its new container port, the day before the meeting begins. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The largest Jewish congregation in Alaska is celebrating its 50th anniversary this weekend. 20 people founded Beth Shalom Synagogue in Anchorage in September 1958, including Beth Rose's parents. I sat down with her and Rabbi Michael Oblath to talk about the history of Beth Shalom, which means House of Peace. Rose says 50 years ago, a number of Jewish families were living in Anchorage, and they wanted to create a place where their children could have a sense of their identity.
Because everybody lived so far away, what ended up happening is that the grandparents were outside, the aunts, the uncles, and everything. There's nobody here to help celebrate and be together. So the small Jewish community became family for everybody and became a place where people could come together and celebrate the Jewish holidays and births and bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, things like that.
Is it just a coincidence that this was happening during statehood, that they founded it right at that time, or was there something that made it significant for the folks then?
There were people that were coming here to help address the needs of the state and help to build a state. And in my parents' situation, my mother and father were living in Washington, D.C., and then Senator Bob Bartlett recommended to my father to come here and help build a state. So there were people who were coming for that reason, and other people who were coming here to just address the many needs that this territory and soon to be state were facing. When they came here, they found there really wasn't a Jewish community that they may have been very familiar with. To be, you know, on a personal level, my own parents outside didn't have to celebrate or didn't have to find their Jewish roots because it surrounded them in Washington. And my mother was from Chicago. It was just around them at all times. Here, there's nothing like that. So they're looking for a place that they could have a religious upbringing for their children and a cultural upbringing. Education was very important to them. And when I went to school, there may have been maybe one or two other Jewish kids in school that I went to, whether it was elementary or middle school or high school. But all of us had a very strong sense of what it was like to be Jewish. We knew what the holidays were. We knew the prayers. We learned Hebrew. And we got all of that in large part because of our parents' commitment. They ended up being our teachers. They set up the Sunday school at the beginning. They were the religious lay leaders for many years. So they really did create a very strong sense of Judaism in a very remote location.
And Rabbi, maybe I should turn to you now for this question. How many members belong to the synagogue?
We have about 200 families, which in the way our movement sort of defines membership, I think that's probably around 700 people or so, 700-800 people.
Do you find that there's any challenges or special struggles with practicing Judaism this far north?
Well, sure. Well, you can even have, if you're very traditional, you have struggles with when do you light the Shabbat candles on Friday night because you light them at sunset, and that time in the extremes of the daylight and darkness can be a real challenge. We tend to standardize it at the synagogue when our services start on Friday nights at 7:30. But some of the challenges are if you keep a fairly strict dietary life with the kosher food laws, you're limited in terms of where you get the food. You have to maybe ship it in or eat in fairly special ways. Some people just will practice vegetarianism because that's strictly kosher by itself. And one of the aspects is that you're isolated. And it's so important within Judaism to be part of a community. But I think the notion of coming together as a community is one that this congregation takes very seriously.
The Beth Shalom congregation is celebrating its 50th anniversary this weekend with several services and a gala event on Saturday evening. More information is online at frozenchosen.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This week on AK, the best of the summer. From super pods of whales, to super active volcanoes, to a super remote music festival. All that and more, this week on AK, from APRN.
Classes have started at the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School, but Anchorage's newest K through 6th grade alternative is still looking for more students and a bus driver. KSKA's Len Anderson explains.
The Alaska Native School is the newest of the district's 7 charter schools. It opened its doors, or rather those of the Muldoon Assembly Community Church, its temporary housing, for the first time last month. At the end of December, the school moves to its permanent location in the former Ashley Furniture Store on Muldoon Road. About 3 weeks ago, the school had only approximately 60 registered students. Monday night, the Native Cultural School principal, Tim Godfrey, told the Anchorage School Board that number had grown considerably.
Today we stand at 147. We need 150 through October, and we feel fairly confident that's going to happen.
150 is a magic funding number for Alaska charter schools. Above 150 students, and the school receives approximately $1.2 million. Below, even at 149, that funding becomes about $600,000. The district administration estimates this year's staffing and facility costs for the new school are likely to be about $1 million. The group who came before the school board this week wanted to talk about the difference the school was already making for some students. Parent Eileen Robinson is white. Her twin 11-year-old adopted sons are Alaska Native. Every day, she or her husband drive from Peters Creek to the school. She says it's already worth it.
I often thought of it at the other school as I was trying to fit 2 square pegs in round holes, that they just didn't fit. And now at school, Alan bounces out of bed every morning. He loves to go to school. He's opening up. And I way underestimated what culture meant to those children.
Principal Godfrey says the school wants to begin every morning as an educational, cultural village. That togetherness also applies to field trips. Recently, the entire school went to Alpenglow to pick berries as well as study soils, terrain, and plants. The gathered berries then became various classroom lessons. For the kindergartners, that was Eskimo ice cream. The school's Alaska Native creators want to teach in a traditional hands-on method, which in Western educational terms is called active inquiry, program-based. This approach has proven attractive.
Approximately 80% of our population is Alaska Native, but we also have various other ethnic groups. We have 2 young African American Muslim girls. We have a Spanish population. We have a Pacific Islander population. We have Caucasians. People are coming to our school because we're offering an alternative that fits the instructional needs of their children.
The biggest hurdle to student recruitment is transportation. Charter schools do not provide busing, but many prospective families who qualify for free or reduced lunches cannot easily provide transportation. Recently, the Sand Lake Elementary School principal called Godfrey. He wondered if busing could be arranged from his West Side school. Como likes the idea.
He's so overcrowded. He's up to 675 students, and he's had this huge in-migration of Alaska Native families in Sand Lake area, which I was amazed, and so was he. But there is a high interest on the part of those parents to going to this charter school.
Busing students would increase the state per student funding, with a portion of that money paying for the bus driver. The bus company, Forsyth, says it's willing if a driver can be found. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska artist and teacher Fran Reed died yesterday morning in Anchorage of cancer. She was 65. Reed started out as a weaver, teaching at UAF, but for the last few decades, she worked mostly with fish skins and hog gut, creating baskets, lamps, and vases. Her work has won numerous awards and is included in permanent collections in museums across Alaska. AK's Jessica Cochran attended a workshop taught by Reed in 2004. We found this story in the AK archives.
Walking down the stairs to Fran Reed's basement, the first thing I notice is the smell.
Reed and her three students have spent the morning scraping flesh off of halibut skins, working with ulus on cutting boards.
And normally when you scrape skins, you use a duller ulu, like this one, and then it won't cut the skins quite so much. But this is just to get the meat off of it that was left on by the fish market. And if I were working with other skins that had fins and tails on them, then I would take a scalpel to those areas around the fin and tail to be sure to get all of the meat out of there. This can just get cut off on the side.
Reed first discovered fish skin sewing in 1986. She saw several pieces by Native artists on display or for sale, and at the same time hosted a skin artist from the lower 48 at her house. Now she's one of only a few people left in Alaska who work with fish skins. She'll try almost any fish she can get her hands on. Burbot from a friend in Fairbanks, salmon her husband catches in Chitna, and halibut collected from fish stores. Her other materials are collected, driftwood from Cook Inlet, willow twigs, or bought, artificial sinew for the thread, bamboo, and reeds. She owns two of the traditional Native baskets that first attracted her to fish skin work. An Athabaskan two-fish basket is made from salmon skins, fins still attached, and shaped into a cylinder. This would have been used as a lunch pail. Another piece was made for her by a Yupik woman.
This is Anna Alexi from Bethel, and she has taken the dorsal fin out and patched it in. And she used fish skins from her winter food source. So as she was eating her smoked fish, she cleverly saved that skin, and she had enough of it, so then she could wash it really well and scrape it really well and stitch it together into this nice little bag, which is quite flexible and would be easily used as a raincoat or mittens or boots.
Reed was inspired by the work of these artists, but she is entirely self-taught, and her work is very different, less utilitarian, for one. Her halibut skin fishing hat would quickly collapse and rot in the rain, and the intricate bowls made around driftwood aren't really meant to hold much. Reed recently taught a workshop in Unalaska. Among the students were several people who work at Native Culture Spirit Camps, where they'll teach the craft to anyone who wants to join in the revival. I'm Jessica Cochran.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Jessica Cochran from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Proffitt is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4 and then Alaska. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.